Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, August 14th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. We finally made it. This was another really long week, so I'm happy that it's here. It's 71 degrees and partly cloudy here in upstate New York. Looks like we have rain coming here within the next hour. Hopefully it's not thunderstorms. I saw some red and yellow in there. I have headphones on, so I get a little paranoid about that. Yeah, well, let's continue from where we left off yesterday. There was some pretty crazy stuff this week. We titled the show Evolutionary Robotics, Focused Destruction, and Biodesign. If you remember, we talked about all kinds of stuff. Some of the investments we mentioned that Bill Gates is making in regards to his CureVac, the RNA people vaccination company. Yes, good old RNA vaccines to be able to flip switches on and off with synthetic, some sort of synthetic particles or nanotechnology. We also found out that Bill Gates was investing $2 billion of his personal money into clean energy, and then discovered that the Department of Energy, as well as many, 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 many other departments in the federal government, have been investing tons of money into research and development of synthetic biology. And we're going to get back to that document today. Also, we found out Bill Gates, as well as 13 other investors, are pouring $120 million into a gene editing startup. Of course, we looked at gene drives, as well as the CRISPR-Cas9 technology and all of the horror that can be created, as well as promise, but I don't think it's promise, where we can literally create suicide genes and wipe out entire populations. So where do we continue? We ended the show looking at that Department of Energy synthetic biology report to Congress from 2013 and discovered that there was something called the National Bioeconomy Blueprint as well. I want to get over there. But before we get there, I found a short interview. It's actually about 10 minutes with good old shill Michio Kaku talking about transhumanism. And if you give me just one second here, let's connect, because I think this will be a great way to kick off the Friday show. And if it lets me, I don't know, I think my machine runs out of memory by the end of the week because I just have my research continuing all week long. All right, I think it's connected. All right, let's check out Michio.
Just last year, for the first time in world history, a memory was recorded.
We can actually tape record a memory and insert it back into an animal, and it remembers. This is amazing. At Wake Forest University, also in Los Angeles, they took a mouse, trained a mouse to sip water, recorded the memory in the hippocampus right here, small organ that processes memory. The mouse later forgot that. Then they shot the memory back into the mouse, and bingo, the mouse got it the first try. Next will be primates. Perhaps a monkey eating a banana will record that memory and insert it back in. And the short-term goal is to create a brain pacemaker for Alzheimer's patients.
Of course it is. Oh no, I got that echo back. All right, I'll just shut up and play this.
In the future, we're going to have millions of people who forget where they live, wander around. Why not have a button? You push the button and you immediately remember where you live, who you are, who your kids are, and be up.
And you push a button, and all of a sudden, all those bad memories go away, and they can insert anything they want. You know, we looked at this when it first was happening. Oh, this was probably the end of last year or so. DARPA was doing all kinds of research for quote-unquote PTSD patients, being able to remove traumatic memories and insert new ones. I'm sure that this is some very similar research. I think he said it was happening at Wake University, which I don't know, but I will guarantee you that there's some sort of seed funding from places such as DARPA or some other federal agency as part of the Brain Project. And of course, it's going to be to help those poor Alzheimer's patients. And we have such an abundance of dementia patients now in the United States. I mean, what a perfect way to spend some research dollars.
On that, who knows? Maybe we'll upload the vacation that you never had.
it seems so mind-blowing to me to consider that memory, which is not a static thing, it's always changing, it's evolving depending on our experiences, can be digitized. It's really mind-blowing. But I want to ask you about something else that you mentioned in the book, the ability for telepathy. And you've actually said in the past that in the future, humans will be able to mentally contact anybody we want, see whatever image we want, and if we don't like it, we can just turn it off. That's
really
right.
This is just insane. And I know Michu is a total shill, but this stuff is not too far in the future, guys, at all.
In the future, in fact, today we can get so that you walk into a room, we'll put on a headset, such that you can control the lights, turn on the TV, call for your car, tell your car where to go, type, dictate documents without ever touching a computer screen. And our children will wonder, how could you possibly live in a world where you had to touch the screen and you had a mouse and you had to type? Everybody just thinks and types, makes documents, controls cars.
It's fascinating where we're headed, and it seems like it really is inevitable. And I think a lot is taken for granted over the things that we're already able to do now. I mean, you were just referring to these sensors in the brain that can capture images inside the brain. What are some of the other practical applications that these things could have?
Well, this will replace the internet. It'll become a brain net. We'll record emotions, thoughts, patterns of behavior, and send it on the internet. Teenagers will love it. Can you imagine Facebook? You send emotions, your first date, your first kiss, your first senior prom, all on the internet. Teenagers already put little like happy faces on their emails, right? We're going to be able to record thoughts, and the movies are going to be replaced by the brain net. Movies today are a flat screen with sound. That's the movies, right? In the future, perhaps emotions and feelings will also be conveyed. This is called total immersion entertainment.
It's amazing. And actually, that reminds me of this new movie that's coming out now, this Johnny Depp movie called Transcendence, where it kind of takes that premise as well, you know, taking your consciousness and uploading it.
I saw that movie. It was horrible, by the way, Transcendence.
Digitally, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, you make it sound like it's going to be a lot of fun, but it also, there's aspects that I think are a little bit terrifying, and I wanted to ask you about this new pill that's being developed that can slow down a person's perception of time, and what's being said is that, you know, this could be applied to prisoners, and given, they'll take a pill, it'll slow down the perception of time so that eight hours could feel like a thousand years sentence. How would this work, and why does the future sound so terrifying?
Do you guys remember that story? This clip is from March 29th of 2014, and I remember covering that story. I didn't realize it was a pill, but I knew that they were working on that technology. Yeah, they were saying, you know, for prison sentences, they can actually make you feel like you've been in prison for 1,000 years, like locking you in Dante's hell. And this is absolutely horrifying to me. And why are we allowing them to crack all the secrets of the brain? I mean, to be able to upload all your thoughts. Don't think, I mean, today with the way surveillance is, uploading all your thoughts means that they'll be able to read all your thoughts. And he's like, oh, yeah, the teenagers will love it. Oh, yeah.
Well, we are tinkering with the brain itself. For example, people who have traumatic memories of war, sometimes they're paralyzed with these horrible memories of a rape, an accident, warfare. We can create a forgetful drug that actually takes the edge off many of our most violent and oppressive memories. However, the President's Commission on Bioethics recommended against marketing the forgetful drug.
Well, did you just hear that? The President's Cabinet of Bioethics recommended against the forgetful drug. Yeah, I'm sure that some of the alphabet agencies probably have their hands on it, like the CIA. But as far as the public is concerned, nah, we're not going to use that forget drug.
Because they said that even unpleasant memories are useful. We learn from them. But personally, I think that sometimes some memories are so disastrously awful that they paralyze you. They prevent you from becoming a normal person. And I think we should allow forgetful drugs to be marketed.
Oh, my God. Good old meet you. Yes, let's make sure everyone gets the forgetful drug. Forget all the crime. Forget all the bullshit that's going on in the world. And hey, we just discovered where the happy area of the brain is. So we're just going to make sure you're all happy. Don't worry, be happy, right?
Also, drugs and therapies which can perhaps even increase intelligence are now being talked about. We'll have perhaps memories that we can upload into the mind, perhaps memories of a job that we're not trained for. Or perhaps a college student will upload a course that they flunked in college. We can perhaps increase our intelligence. And now we're also investigating super intelligence, photographic memory. People who memorize everything. They hear a concert, they see a landscape, they can draw the landscape, they can reproduce the entire concert on one try. How is it possible that people have that mind? We now believe that the mind records, but the mind also forgets deliberately. These people, the forget mechanism is broken. They never forget.
I have a friend like that, by the way. I use selective forgetfulness. It comes in handy sometimes.
They have a photographic memory, and we think that some great scientists of the past had this ability, the ability to have access to powers of the mind that we cannot as mortals.
Right, and this is nothing new. This is something that you know can date back for a very long time. People that have those photographic memories, and you've actually said that right now, the time that we're living in is the golden age for learning about the mind. That we've learned more in the last 15 years than in all of prior human history. Why? What took so long?
Because only recently have we had the physics, the instruments like the MRI scans that are sensitive enough to see the blood flow of the thinking brain down to like a tenth of a millimeter. And now we have supercomputers that can actually read these thoughts and control computers by thinking. So,
and of course, we also now have the executive order inked for the supercomputing initiative to be able to deal with all this. This is just so awesome.
By thinking, we can now control mechanical arms, mechanical legs. We can type. We can control thermostats, turn on the web, change a channel on a TV set, turn on the toaster. All of it just mentally. And at the next International Soccer Games in Brazil, scientists at Duke University want to take someone who's totally paralyzed, outfit him with an exoskeleton, and he will introduce the International Soccer Games in Brazil.
That's amazing. And actually, one of those things that I've always enjoyed about your work is you're very gifted in taking these complex theories and making them easier to understand. I wanted to ask you about this recent discovery about the gravitational waves that are essentially remnants of the Big Bang. Can you explain why this is such an amazing discovery?
Well, we think that at the instant of the Big Bang, gravity waves, waves that we've never seen before, dominated the Big Bang. And now we see them with our detectors in the South Pole. Einstein predicted this 98 years ago. And it took 98 years for us to see that at the instant of creation, there were, in fact, gravity waves. Now, this is very incredible because it means that the Big Bang was a quantum event, meaning that there's a probability it could happen again and again and again, creating a multiverse of parallel universes. So our universe may not be the only universe. This result has philosophical, theological implications. If the Big Bang happened once, as a quantum event, it can happen again.
It's a subject that's so almost impossible for the human mind, at least mine, to even fathom. But you bring up a good point, because there's another subject that's very interesting that you discuss, is God. You describe yourself as a pantheist, and I was hoping that for our viewers that don't know what pantheism means, you could explain that and how that ties into your work in theoretical physics.
Well, Einstein was asked the question about God, and he says there are really two kinds of God. First is the personal God, the God that answers your prayers, that smites your enemies and the Philistines. But he didn't believe in that God. He believed in the God of Spinoza, the God of harmony, beauty, simplicity. You know, the universe could have been ugly. It could have been random. It could have been chaotic. And yet, here we are in an orderly universe that obeys very simple laws. You can put all the laws of physics on one sheet of paper. That's simplicity and elegance. And that's the God of Einstein, the God of Spinoza, the God of harmony. And that's the God that I lean toward. That is, the universe itself is so gorgeous, and it didn't have to be that way.
I think that's something...
And you know what? I absolutely agree about the simplicity and the beauty, and that is why all of this completely mad science gone mad technology is so upsetting to me, because it doesn't need improvement. It happened by itself or from some super intelligent creation. And why are we messing with this? Why are we going to put the imperfectness of human thought, human emotion, human evil into something that is so perfect and so beautiful and so simple? We're going to turn it into the Isle of Dr. Moreau on a planetary, if not a solar system or universal level. We should not be making ourselves gods.
We can all get behind. I'd love to continue to talk about God and the universe and everything. I want to talk about something a little bit more earthly, something a little bit closer to home that you've been outspoken about as well, which is Fukushima and the nuclear crisis in Japan. There's so much disinformation out there. What is the severity of the crisis right now as you see it?
The crisis is much more severe than we're led to believe. Documents have been coming out over the last 2 years showing how the utility and the government deliberately suppressed vital information. Did you know that even as the accident was progressing, and they said, don't worry, everything's under control, they were contemplating evacuating Tokyo. Evacuating Tokyo. I mean, it's mind-boggling, but that's how severe the accident was. Now, right now, we have three melted reactors. It'll take 40 years, by their estimate, to clean up this disastrous accident, and it could start again anytime soon. A small earthquake could tip it over, and the accident starts all over again.
I mean,
yeah, and spent fuel pool number three tips over, that's pretty much the end of life as we know it. What's very interesting, and I was thinking about this yesterday when we were doing the show and looking at the evolutionary robotics, where they were doing simulations and actually some real experiments with robots, but in the simulations, they were doing the extinction simulation, showing that how when you extinct a population, so it's brought down to 90% death, that 10% that comes back and recreates life is going to be more perfect and learns from all the mistakes of the past. You know, people look at Fukushima and go, how could this be continuing? Why isn't the world stepping up to do something to fix this? Well, hey guys, we're seeing now mass deaths all over the Pacific Ocean and cancer rates going up. I saw the mortality rate for infants. I think the study came out last year is way up. You know, there's cancers left and right and all these horrible diseases that, you know, who knows where they're coming from. It could be chemicals or it could be radiation. But here's my point. If we're at the brink of the sixth great extinction, and in the minds of the lunatics that are running the asylum, if it looks like we're going to be more perfect humans after a 90% extinction, hey, why not? Especially if they are protected.
That's it really is insanity, nuclear insanity, really. Like I said before, though, like and as you mentioned, you know, that sounds like a conservative estimate, 40 years for the cleanup. There's so many conflicting reports that are coming out. The seafood's safe to eat. Oh, no, it's not. The radiation's going to hit the West Coast, and other scientists will disagree. What will be the long-term impacts? Is this an everlasting crisis?
It's not an everlasting crisis, but there are dead zones. Dead zones around the reactor. That'll be dead zones for decades to come. And all of us have a piece of Fukushima in you. I can take a Geiger counter right to your body and detect some of the radiation from the reactor. However, it's minimal. So don't think that...
Yeah, but it's in you, which that's the thing, you know, external radiation versus internal. Big difference there when you got particles lodged in your body radiating for the next, oh, I don't know, what's the minimum? You know, iodine is a pretty short lifespan. I don't remember what it is, maybe a few days, but then you have cesium, 35 years. Plutonium, we got hundreds of thousands to millions of years. You know, one of the other things I was thinking about, they're like, oh, this is going to be, you know, for at least decades, or hey, maybe even millions of years. But remember the DARPA lady? She had talked about a few days ago when we were looking at synthetic biology and genetically modifying organisms to terraform Mars. She had said, we're going to test it on Earth first in some of these regions that have been so decimated by human activity and fix it to the way it was before. Maybe that's part of the plan. Let Fukushima kill a large majority of people, bring the population down, because you know that the whole carbon footprint, according to Bill Gates, is what's killing the planet. We need to bring that number down to zero. And once the numbers for population have come down, now let's release some of our genetically modified mad science gone mad organisms and let them fix and eat the radiation.
Everything is going to be radioactive here in the United States. It's not that way. Food you can eat. However, we have to monitor the food very carefully, because we do know that radioactive cesium, with a half-life of about 30 years, leaked into the ocean, and it's water-soluble. And it did get into the fish and sea life around Fukushima. But the government does monitor these things, and so far as we know, the food supply is safe.
Yes, and we believe them, don't we?
Well, I mean, I hope so. I hope that we can eat this food. And I did want to ask you, you know, given that the crisis, like you said, another minor earthquake could trigger another meltdown.
Another tipping point.
Exactly. Right. And this, there's so many different reactors all over the world. There's so many here in the United States. Do you think that as a result of Fukushima, you know, what we've learned from Chernobyl, that in the future we'll eventually do away with nuclear energy? Do you see us moving beyond that?
Well, Germany has already thrown in the towel. Germany says never again. They saw what happened at Fukushima. A disaster in Germany could literally wipe out Germany as a nation. And so they're phasing out nuclear entirely. Switzerland follows suit. Italy is sort of teetering right now. And even Japan is teetering on the brink. They have a national debate as to whether or not to go nuclear or not.
Yeah, and Japan actually just fired up a few days ago the very first nuclear reactor again since the disaster in 2011.
See, after World War II, Japan made the Faustian bargain. Faust was a legendary figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power.
Yeah, sold his soul to the United States government.
That's the Faustian bargain that Japan made after the war. And now they're going to have to reanalyze whether it's worth it to sell your soul to the devil.
Well, that's the future of nuclear energy, I suppose. Dr. Michio Kaku, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
All right. Good old Michio. So he touched on a whole bunch of subjects. I really wanted to just look at the transhumanist and being able to upload your mind to the machine. He had talked about religion as well. And some of the different ways you could view it. That reminded me of a story I came across the other day. Artificial intelligence will make religion obsolete in our lifetime. It says, after conquering the kitchen, the game show, and outer space, are our machines heading for religion next? Hold on, I had to disconnect. The singularity is hypothesized is a hypothesized time in the future, approximately 2045. And yeah, blame Kurzweil for that one and the Russian billionaire with the 2045 project, when the capabilities of non-living electronic machines will supersede human capabilities. Undismissible contemporary thinkers like Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, and Ray Kurzweil warn us that it will change everything. Hawking likens it to receiving a message from aliens announcing their arrival in a few decades, saying this is more or less what is happening with artificial intelligence. The tension between technology and the human soul dates all the way back to the Old Testament. In the story of the Tower of Babel, God responds to humanity's construction of a tower tall enough to reach heaven by confusing their languages to inhibit their progress. And I wish someone would confuse our languages right now, because we are reaching to the sky. Quote, the story is a pretty big warning against becoming too technologically capable, says Jason Stellman and Christian Kingery, former pastors who host a philosophical comedy podcast called Drunk Ex-Pastors. Oh, actually, that sounds pretty fun. I might have to look that one up. As far as Christianity is concerned, the singularity probably won't go over too well with God. Well, here's the thing. And I mean, get rid of all the religious bullshit. We are literally putting ourselves into the driver's seat as gods. That's why this is so dangerous. And we have put ourselves at the brink of these lunatics being in charge with things such as the gene drives, that they can just set something loose and wipe out entire species. All right, back to the story. We have low-grade artificial intelligence systems today, and they control the robots exploring Mars, beat humans at Jeopardy, and generally force us to ask complicated questions about the nature of knowledge and understanding. But that is nothing compared to what we can expect in the future. Electronics of this caliber would be described as super intelligent. They would be conversational and aware, like C-3PO from Star Wars. Yeah. Talk of the singularity ripples with religious undertones. It is obsessed with the unknown future and assumes the arrival of a superior entity down the road. It has its naysayers and true believers alike, each eager to tell you why and why not such an entity will actually show up. And, you know, what's really cool about this is I was thinking about that the other day. Like, Michio had just said about the Big Bang repeating itself and being able to detect those gravitational waves. And they're pretty certain that it has happened over and over and over again, and maybe even created parallel universes. We've also found evidence, and the guest that Solvener had on a few weeks ago, I don't remember his name. He was the professor out of the university in Massachusetts, the geologist and archaeologist, who had talked about finding the same thing, that there are civilizations, and we know this, that are way before what we had thought, and that they seriously think that there might have been some sort of solar event, possibly, that wiped out the majority of humans, and we were reborn pretty much from just a few people and created the civilization today. Who's to say that there weren't more advanced civilizations in the past, and the singularity, the second coming, the becoming one with quote unquote God didn't have something to do with us trying to transcend, right? That's what this is all about. Us trying to transcend the physical body to become something greater. Well, placing human brains into a machine or uploading your memories into the cloud, I don't call that transcendence. I call that a complete, utter fucking nightmare. All right, back to this. We spoke to seven thinkers and scholars to learn what might happen when superintelligence bumps into religion. John Messerly, affiliate scholar for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. There is no specific religious suggestion that we'll face a technological singularity. In fact, ancient scriptures from various religions say virtually nothing about science and technology, and what they do say about them is usually wrong. People still interpret their religious scriptures, revelations, and beliefs in all sorts of ways. So a fundamentalist might say that the singularity is the end of the world. as foretold by the book of Revelations or something like that. Well, I hate to say it, I'm not a fundamentalist, but I kind of agree with that. The book of Revelations, man, the end of everything as we know it. I mean, I think we saw last week, in the same week, we had a plague of locusts, a fireball in the sky in Argentina, and the typhoon that hit Taiwan, floods, locusts, and portents in the sky. Lincoln Cannon, president of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Yeah, SLC, I guess they have Mormon transhumanists. He says the Bible contains many ideas that religious transhumanists tend to associate with emerging and future technology risks and opportunities. On the negative side, some see risks of unfriendly superintelligence and prophecies related to the Antichrist. And you know what? We just saw the other day about those chipping parties and how great it's going to be. Insert the chip, blah, blah, blah. To me, this stuff is horrifying. I mean, if you take religious scripture, and I mean, I'm not talking like just Bible. I'm talking like quote unquote myths from different cultures around the world. And you look at creation and destruction myths, and then you just click them a couple degrees to the right and then apply all the craziness that's happening right now. It's very, very frightening to me. Peter Moon. He's a PhD candidate at Sal Regina Universities. While I am not a biblical scholar, what I find interesting is that the Bible's Book of Prophecy, Revelation, and Martin Heidegger's concept that technology reveals its complete effect on humanity only after its implementation share the same root word, reveal. Something is shielded from humanity, and only after discovery, uncovering that which is hidden, can we really see the reality before us. And that's exactly what's going to happen. Everyone is sitting here with their arms wide open, thinking that technology is going to be so wonderful because it's going to help us cure disease and, you know, insert memories from Nana's Alzheimer's so she can remember little Johnny and cure cancer with nanobots in your bloodstream. But they're not going to realize until it's too late that we as human 1.0 have been usurped. Duncan Trussell, comedian and the host of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, which I don't know what that is, says you could compare this moment to the development of complex eyes during the Cambrian explosion. Prior to this, all forms of biological life would have experienced a world of absolute darkness, and those creatures that first developed an eye would have experienced a kind of apocalypse. An infinite field of data, formerly inaccessible, opened up to them. Darkness peeled back to reveal the light. Yes, I wouldn't call this light. Neil Van Dee, he's an officiator at the Church of Perpetual Life, and I really don't want to get into religion. Like, come on, how many people do we have to fucking read here? Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, God, this goes on forever. All right, let's read Peter Moon. The question here is this. Will there be a place for God in the singularity? One could say that technological marvels of uploading the mind and consciousness into a cyber environment and then connecting all the minds together may preclude humans from expressing humanity, you think? This thought comes from an idea that the expected scientific environment of ones and zeros makes no room for humanity. However, if consciousness can be exactly translated into a binary environment, the concepts of God, spirituality, and religion, well, this is what he says, will be copied along with everything else, unless those concepts are specifically not copied. I am unlikely to be the first thinker of the spirituality exclusion in the future of the singularity. Well, okay. So will there be religion? And I'm going to say probably not, because the religion is going to be technology. And that is what it is with some of these people. And one of the reasons why I read this is because I ran across something really, really, really frightening when we were searching out the Biodesign Project, which was something that was being spearheaded by DARPA. We listened to a clip from Arizona Biodesign Institute yesterday about, of course, all the new technologies and genetic engineering and nanotechnology and curing everything at a small scale to be able to unleash it on the world to make the world such a better place. This document was titled Accelerating U.S., Israel, neuroscience, and neural technology collaborations. Yes, the U.S. and Israel have been working long and hard on neuroscience and neurotechnology collaborations. And there's a large number of individuals from Israel as well as the United States and one of the dudes from DARPA involved in this group. I also discovered that the U.S. and Israel have been working together on technological innovation since at least 1977. Yes. I mean, I just can't even believe this. So here, let's read about this. The U.S. Israel Bio-National Science Foundation. The establishment of the U.S. Israel Bio-National Science Foundation, more affectionately known as BSF, originated as a result of close ties in scientific and technological cooperation, which have developed over many years between the United States and Israel. Both governments recognize the importance of science and technology in the development of a strong and vigorous national economy, and that international cooperation in science and technology would contribute to the advancement of these fields for the benefits of both countries, as well as mankind generally. And yes, we know the U.S. and Israel are so concerned about mankind. An agreement to establish the United States-Israel Binational Science Foundation was signed in September of 1972. And that happened to be the same year that Nixon inked the end of quote-unquote U.S. bio-warfare. He signed on to that Geneva Convention, I believe it was. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. Look it up. Search on Wiki history of U.S. bio-warfare and you'll see it. It was in 1972 that we inked on. But remember, Nixon had also talked about us still continuing our defensive posture for biowarfare in the development of vaccines. It says this board, consisting of 10 members from the United, five from the United States, five from Israel, appointed by the respective governments, governs the BSF's operations. And the BSF, the U.S.-Israel Binational Science Foundation, conducts its operations from where? Oh, Jerusalem. The BSF mostly awards research grants, always on a competitive basis, for collaborative projects between Israeli and American scientists. The supported areas of research include health and life sciences, exact and physical sciences, and social sciences. What, like brainwashing? Due to lack of funds, submission of grant applications is accepted on a split program basis, namely in alternate years, either health and life sciences or exact physical and social science applications are submitted. Other programs include short research-related visits to other countries by PhD students and workshops. We have also begun a program in, quote, transformative science, unquote, that looks for somewhat esoteric projects with a transformative potential that do not fare well in regular competitions. Starting in 2012, the BSF engaged in what appears to be an unprecedented number of new joint funding programs with who? Oh, the National Science Foundation. They were one of the crew involved in the synthetic biology. They're also involved in the Brain Project. The scientific merit of each research proposal determined through a peer review process, and the proposals are sent for review to referees in the U.S., Israel, Europe, etc., and over 2,000 reviews are collected each year for about 500 applications. Final evaluations of proposals are rendered by panels of science advisors that include both Israelis and Americans. Among the scientists who have participated in the BSF supported projects are 37 Nobel laureates, including five Israelis, indicating the high quality of research supported by the BSF. And since its inception, they have supported close to 500 joint research projects. the U.S. Israel Science and Technology Foundation, which is abbreviated USISTF, U.S. Israel Science and Technology Foundation, is a Washington-based 501c3 nonprofit organization founded by a joint initiative of the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Israeli Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Labor, with a mission of strengthening the scientific and R&D relationship of the U.S. and Israel to promote economic growth through innovation. The USISTF achieves its mission by convening U.S.-Israel scientific and industry conferences, producing strategy and policy data and publications, and facilitating R&D framework programs that enable joint research activities. The U.S.-Israel Science and Technology Foundation programs are as follows. Through its programs, the USISTF strengthens the scientific alliance between the academic, industry, and policy communities of the United States and Israel that work in emerging areas of technology, creating, oh yes, the solutions of tomorrow from the world's most pressing challenges. The USISTF convenes scientific and industry conferences, workshops that bring together scientific and thought leaders to analyze the state of play in their fields, to generate actionable visions of technology development, and to enable working partnerships to develop next generation technologies. The USISTF considers these events only the beginning of developing action plans to spark concrete collaborations, and always takes the lead in undertaking action plans that lead to true joint programs. The USISTF not only brings scientific and technology leaders from the U.S. and Israel together to address what global challenges, but it also produces the only benchmarking publication that analyzes the state of the U.S.-Israeli innovation relationship against that of the U.S. and eight other countries in order to monitor areas of strength and develop policy ideas to address areas of weaknesses. The U.S.-Israel Innovation Index. I mean, talk about like having this all well thought out. I mean, I can't even believe this. Utilizes quantitative and qualitative metrics in the areas of R&D, human capital, government, and private sector cooperation to paint a full picture of the state of U.S.-Israel innovation relationship. The USISTF works with diverse organizations, strategic partnerships such as the U.S.-Israel Binational Foundations in a broad range of scientific disciplines. And looking to the future, the USISTF continues to broaden its scope of technology areas to spark game-changing U.S.-Israel cooperative activities. And for more information, please contact Ms. Ann Liebelschultz. I mean, can you guys even believe this shit? I'm glad that that Israel is part of the organization that is plotting our future. They, of course, have the Neurotechnology Industry Organization, as well as all other divisions. And that was actually a short document. I thought it was a bit longer than that. Of course, we went through all the names and all the locations. And let's take a look at a couple people who are involved in this. And then we're going to take a look at this whole U.S. bioeconomics. We have, let's see, Executive Officer for the National Academy of Sciences and the National Research Council, Mr. Bruce Darling. We have Executive Director of the Bird Foundation. And Bird was this other organization that I was looking at that's some sort of binational model between U.S. and Israel. We have the Executive Director of the U.S.-Israel Binational Science Foundation, the Executive Director of the U.S.-Israel Science and Technology Foundation. We have Congressman Patrick Kennedy, who's the co-founder of One Mind for Research. Mr. Michael B. Oren is the ambassador of Israel to the United States. We have Dr. Alessio J. Silva. He's from UCLA. Professor John Disterhoff from Northwestern University. Dr. Henry Machnickney, President and Chief Executive Officer of Posit Science. Professor Kobe Rosenblum, who's from the University of Haifa. Dr. Rita Z. Goldstein from Brookhaven National Laboratory. Ding, ding. Dr. Chad Bowden, Research Leader of Battelle. Professor Andrew Swartz, University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Ahmad Yunus from Alpha Omega. That's great. I think I just saw their name come up somewhere not too long ago as well. Good old Colonel Jeffrey Ling from the Defense Science Office of DARPA. He came up in that synthetic biology document that we were talking about. Professor Bernice Grafstein of Weill Cornell Medical College. Professor Alon Friedman of Ben-Gurion University. Dr. James P. Kelly, Director of the National Intrepid Center of Excellence at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. Dr. Jeffrey D. Lewine of the Mind Research Network. Dr. Michael Singer, President and Chief Executive Officer of BrainScope. Professor Hermona Sorek of Hebrew University. Professor Yulal Neria, Columbia University, New York State Psychiatric Institute. Professor Zahava Solomon, Tel Aviv University. Dr. Moran Sheff, U.S. Relations Director of the Israel Brain Technologies. How insane is this? Professor Stephen E. Hyman, Director of the Stanley Center for Psychiatric Research and the Broad Institute at Harvard and MIT. I mean, talk about the pit of vipers. Dr. Henry Brehm, John Hopkins University School of Medicine. Yes, John Hopkins, where they have the huge brain database. Dr. Bill Doyle, Chairman of NovaCure Limited. Dr. Thomas Fu, Chief Scientist, Diagnostic and Biomedical Technologies of WHO, GE Global Research. Dr. Alan I. Leisher, Chief Executive Officer, American Association for the Advancement of Science and Executive Publisher Science. Dr. Jacobo Mintzer of the Medical University at South Carolina. Mr. Ron Godot, CEO of the EI Mind A. Dr. Jeffrey S. Nye, Vice President and Global Head of Neuroscience External Innovation, Janssen Pharmaceutical Companies of Johnson & Johnson. Mr. Ilal Zicardio, VP, Research and Development Director of Neuro Programs of Insight Tech. Dr. Vincent R. Zarowski, Jr., Founder of Veronel, Inc. Dr. Susan W. Burnson, Health Law, Minsk Levin. Dr. Zach Lynch, Executive Director of Neurotechnology Industry Organization. And they are all part of this Israeli-U.S. Binational Industrial Research and Development Foundation, more affectionately known as BIRD. I want to read a little bit about BIRD as well. BIRD is a key catalyst for the joint research and development between the U.S. and Israeli companies focusing on emergency industries and novel technologies with significant commercial potential. Any pair of companies, one Israeli and one American, may jointly apply for BIRD support so long as they have combined capability and infrastructure to define, develop, manufacture, market, sell, and support innovative products based on industrial research and development. Once the companies have decided to collaborate, they jointly submit a brief executive summary of the proposed project. And following a quick review, Bird advises the companies on whether they should submit a full-scale proposal. The Bird Foundation Board of Governors approves these proposals twice a year, and approvals are based on the review by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technologies. Hey, another one working on synthetic biology, that's good old NIST. And the Office of Chief Scientists, another one from the synthetic biology document, that's the OCS. Of Israel's Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Labor. The Bird Foundation offers conditional grants for joint development projects on a risk-sharing basis, and the foundation funds up to 50% of each company's R&D expenses associated with that joint project. Repayments are due only if commercial revenues are generated as a result of the project, and if a project fails, Bird claims no repayments. Bird acquires no equity in the company supported and no intellectual property rights in their products. Oh, so how wonderful. They just rain money from the sky to ensure U.S. and Israeli collaboration in mad science gone mad. The foundation does not interfere in formulating or managing the relationships between partnering companies. Bird's scope extends to communications, clean technology, electronics, internet and media, homeland security, life science, semiconductors, software, and other areas of innovative technologies with commercial potentials. Cumulative sales of products developed through Bird projects have exceeded $8 billion, and since Bird's inception in 1977, over 800 projects have been approved with leading companies in the United States, including, and then they don't give you the name of the companies. It says Bird encourages all companies, which is kind of neat that they don't put any companies there that were involved. Bird encourages all companies, large, medium, or small, to submit proposals. I mean, I really don't want to harp on this, but to me, this was a pretty horrifying thought. We have some other country that is working in the middle of all these mad science gone mad technologies, including neuroscience and brain projects. And like, I really trust Israel with the future brains of America. So we then find out why we were reading this document, which was the Department of Energy's synthetic biology report to Congress of 2013 that listed out like all of these organizations in the federal government that were a part of synthetic biology projects, federal R&D activities. We discovered that there was another document that came out in April 2012 titled the National Bioeconomy Blueprint. And I wanted to read a little bit of this as well. This is the executive summary, quote, by Obama, December 6th of 2011. The world is shifting to an innovation economy, and nobody does it better than America and Israel, apparently. Economic activity that is fueled by research and innovation in the biological sciences, the quote unquote bioeconomy, is a large and rapidly growing segment of the world economy that provides substantial public benefit. Yes, or the destruction of all life on Earth. The bioeconomy has emerged as an Obama administration priority because its tremendous potential for growth, as well as many other societal benefits it offers. Yes, like depopulation. It can allow Americans to live longer, healthier lives, reduce our dependence on oil, address key environmental challenges, transform manufacturing processes, increase productivity and scope of the agricultural sector while growing new jobs and industries. And if we decode that, yes, it'll help us live longer. Well, that's the Immortality Project. Healthier lives, yes, that's the nanobots in your bloodstream. reduce dependence on oil. Yes, that's some sort of mad science. Biofuels address key environmental challenges. Well, DARPA's working on that one with their GM bacteria that can go in and manipulate our environment and make things better and fix it to the way it was before we polluted it all. Transform manufacturing processes, yes, with robots that'll take our jobs, and increase productivity and scope of agriculture sector, yes, Monsanto and GM foods, while growing new jobs and industries, yes, for biopharma that does not include you and me. Lots of research and developments that are funded by this apparent U.S.-Israeli angel venture capital funding group. It says, back to this document, the decade of life science research and the development of increasingly powerful tools such as gene drives for obtaining and using biological data have brought us closer to the threshold of a previously unimaginable future. Yes, the dystopian future of science fiction gone completely off the rails that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. It sure as hell was unimaginable. Back to this. Ready to burn liquid fuels produced directly from CO2, biodegradable plastics, not made from oil, but renewable biomass, tailor food products to meet specialized dietary requirements. Yes, 3D printed GM foods made out of insect protein. Personalized medical treatments. Yes, good old personalized medicine. Based on a patient's own genomic information and novel biosensors for real-time monitoring of the environment and your health. I mean, how insane is this? And this is our new bioeconomy based upon edict from the White House. Increasingly, scientists and engineers are looking to augment biological research with approaches and reality, by the way, with approaches from other scientific disciplines for solutions to our most demanding scientific and societal changes and seeing exciting options that will profoundly affect our future. And I would have to second that assessment. So Why the Future Doesn't Need Us Anymore by Bill Joy, page 3. It says, and I promised I'd get to this yesterday, accustomed to living with almost routine scientific breakthroughs, we have yet to come to terms with the fact that most compelling 21st century technologies, that being robotics, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology, pose a different threat than technologies that have come before. Specifically, robots, engineered organisms, and nanobots, and remember, this story is out of 2000, out of Wired, share a dangerous amplifying factor. They can self-replicate. A bomb is only blown up once, but one bot can become many and quickly get out of control. Much of my work over the last 25 years has been on computer networking, where the sending and receiving of messages creates the opportunity for out-of-control replication. But while replication in a computer or on a computer network can be a nuisance, at worst it disables a machine and takes down a network, uncontrolled self-replication in these newer technologies, yes, like the gene drive or nanobots, runs a much greater risk, a risk of substantial damage in the physical world. And each of these technologies also offers untold promise. The vision of immortality that Kurzweil sees in his robot dreams drives us forward. Genetic engineering may soon provide treatments, if not outright cures, for most diseases. And nanotechnology and nanomedicine can address more ills, and together they can extend the average lifespan. But we should be afraid, because like WMDs, this could wipe out biological life on a global scale and make it broken forever. All right, guys, Everybody, make sure you stick around. It's Friday, and Ms. Lonnie Clark is up next. Josh, live at 6 p.m. Eastern. Primetime replay with Nick and Michael at 8. Truth on the Tracks with Brandon at 9. Reality Bites, brand new. Neil Foster at 10. Anti-Media Radio with LaVon at 11. Awesome programming all weekend, Saturday and Sunday. All new shows. And then... and I don't know where my music is. It seems to be getting later every day. I will catch up with you guys on Monday. Everybody have an awesome weekend. Take care.